Thank you all for coming. This is the panel on development of MUDs and MORPs, or MMORPG. I tend not to say it. I tend to just type it a lot. For those who aren't sure what the MUD is, a multi-user dungeon. MORP is the massively multiplayer online role-playing game. And we have panelists here. We've all been involved with the creation of online games. First, though, I want to kind of get a sense of who's here in the audience. How many people here have played online multiplayer games? Okay, good. All right. How many people here want to get into the industry? You want to develop online games?
I'm sorry.
How many people are developing online games right now?
I'm especially sorry.
Okay. The people who are developing, I just want to hear which games? Oh, D-Gate. Okay, cool. You want to come up and sit on the panel? Come on up. Who else have we got here who does this? Some revenue probably has to be. Well, actually, do you guys make any revenue off of
this? Actually. I make enough to buy ramen noodles.
Who else do we have here that's a developer? Which games?
Tiny Mush.
Tiny Mush, okay. You want to be on the panel? No, okay. And in the back?
Daiku,
you want to be up here? No? Okay. Anybody else that is developing an online game and wants to be up here on the panel? No? Okay, all right. You guys are brave. Okay. I'll probably be adjusting the slides as we go, since D-Gate has been around for a long, long, long time. So D-Gate opened 1990... Gemstone. Let's introduce each other. Start with D-Gate. You want to introduce yourself real quick?
Sure. My name is Roy Sutton. Unfortunately, I don't get paid for programming for D-Gate, but that's not unusual, I think, for most people developing MUDs. I've been the programmer for D-Gate for, 5-6 years now.
Okay. All right.
I'm Brian Green, known online as PsychoChild. I program for Meridian 59.
My name is Matt Mahaley. I founded a text mud company called Achaea. We have two commercial products, Achaea and Aetolia, both medieval fantasy games.
I've played on Achaea before.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's very nice.
Excellent. Thank you.
My name is Ilanka Dunnan. I'm a general manager of online community for Simutronics Corporation. That's Play.net. I've been doing this for about 12 years now, back from the days when it was just an apartment loft, and now I have a corner office in a 10,000-square-foot office building in St. Louis, Missouri. And so I've seen the industry go from when it was an hourly rate, $12, $18 even. I have a press release where the head of Genie was announcing proudly that the rates were lowering to $12 an hour. And so now where you can get like $10 or it's $12.95 a month is basically the standard right now. I've seen a lot of changes in the industry over the years. Okay. So we can kind of do this different ways. We have some pre-prepared questions that we can go through, or if there's anyone in the audience that really has a question, really wants to kind of hit us with something in particular and find out what we think about the industry, we can go back and forth from slides to audience Q&A. I really have no strong preference. So we'll start off by saying, is there anybody in the audience that has a burning question? They just absolutely want to make sure this question gets asked as part of the panel. Okay. All right, so we'll start with this. In terms of design process, we'll go down the row here. How does each of the developers of these games, how do you handle the design process and the implementation process? Why do you do it that way? For example, do you do things where you're putting in a few changes each day, or do you kind of save up all the changes and then do this huge burst of changes like quarterly or something like that? Okay. Matt, why don't you start, and then we'll go.
Okay. We develop iteratively because, initially, like a lot of text mods, we started off. It was meant to be a business, but I didn't really know what I was doing, and we just kind of started running it like a hobby. And we find the iterative updates, as opposed to the large updates like the EverQuest updates and whatnot, provide us the opportunity to respond to what the players want, right then. So if a player needs or if a players want you know, X feature, a change to our bloodline system that lets you track your families. We can make that, you know, right then, and we just find that works a lot better for the style of game we run.
Meridian 59 is kind of interesting. A lot of my questions are going to be before and after. Just a bit of history. Meridian 59 was launched in 1996. It was shut down. It was run by the 3DO company. It was shut down in August of 2000, and then Near Death Studios, the company that I helped co-found, bought Meridian 59, all rights to Meridian 59 again, and we relaunched it early this year in May. So previously, it was big updates. One of the main reasons for that is you could do a full development cycle. It was what the company was used to. You know, you could put all your updates into one, all your little updates into one big update. You could test it fully. You could send it through the bank of testers they had in the company. Also, it was great marketing. You know, hey, look, we've released a new update, and here's its name. Recently, we've been more iterative, trying to get the game back up and running and stable, doing a lot of little patches to try to get things balanced, get things working right. Personally, I'd like to go back to big updates just for the reasons I mentioned before, where, you know, you can do a full testing cycle. You know, a lot of people know that one little change to the game can ruin lots and lots of things. You know, you don't always catch everything during testing, but, you know, you have a better chance of catching it, you know, if you do it then. Plus the marketing, you know, we're working on trying to get the word out, hey, Meridian 59's back. Hey, look, we're doing updates. You know, we're updating the game. We're not just going to put it up and forget about it.
I use basically an iterative process to bring out the updates. We have a very stable community and code base, and so changes are usually of a small incremental nature. So an iterative process works very well. For large changes to major systems, we try and stage those for release after some extensive testing.
And our own games, we definitely do things on a daily basis. We've got a team of hundreds of game masters that are in the game changing things, and we have a game engine that's the kind where we can be changing the logic and the AI of monsters as someone is fighting them. And we find that that's really what our customers want. They want to know that each time they log into the game, there's the possibility of something new that's going to be happening, or that something maybe, you know, changed, the logic maybe changed in some way. It's not always a happy thing. Sometimes someone gets used to the way the magic crystal will always work in such and such a way, and then they log in one day and it doesn't work that way, and they get very upset. But overall, most of our customers say that they want something new each day.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. It's, you know, competing against companies like Sony and Microsoft, EverQuest, Astron's Call, you know, we're all fairly small developers. Simutronics is probably a magnitude larger than IKEA, and these guys are probably around IKEA's size. So the only way we can really compete against EverQuest and those kinds of juggernauts is to provide something they can't. And because they're doing a retail product release where they, you know, they stick their updates into the store, they have to be fully tested. They have to go through a full development cycle, which slows down the pace they can respond to the players. And so that's one thing we can offer that they can't. And that's one of the major reasons I think we probably all do things that way. Or, you know, she and I do.
Another reason why we prefer to do big updates too is we support international licensees. We've got a German company that's localized Meridian 59 into German, and we just signed an agreement with an Italian company. It's a lot easier to hand them large updates to localize than to, you know, hand them a bunch of small updates we did over several days. Plus, another thing is Meridian 59 is not hot patchable. We have to take down the game. To patch the game, we have to, you know, people generally have to download something for new graphics, all that stuff. So it works a lot better for our game to do large updates instead of daily iterative updates.
Another question I want to ask of the audience. How many people here have played a game of somebody here on the panel? Okay. How many people here have played EverQuest? Okay. Ultima Online? Asheron's Call? Dark Age of Camelot, a game that predates any of those, right? Yeah, like Shadow of Asterbius or Towers of Twinion, or, you know, one of the old Sierra games or something like that. If any big games that I'm missing here?
No.
Armageddon. Okay. Anarchy Online. Just curious. All right.
Well.
They are big fans of it. It's unusual because Anarchy Online differs from many of the other warps in that they started off with a really poor product. I mean, it was totally unplayable when AL first went online. I checked it out probably about 3 months ago, and it's actually become a very stable morph engine. But unfortunately, the company that is producing Anarchy Online is now has put out indicators that they're no longer going to be supporting it.
Yeah, I met someone at E3. It was either E3 or the Game Developers Conference this year, who was from that company, and I was stunned to hear him say that those customers, they expect us to offer customer service or something. Well, we've decided we are not going to offer customer service. If they want customer service, go play some other game.
I'm like, my understanding was that it was postponed indefinitely. But I don't. That may be incorrect. I don't really follow the game, but I just have a lot of friends that do play.
And Anarchy Online's release really illustrates the power that you guys have in online games as the community, because it is, as you say, it had a very rocky launch, and Funcom did revise it until it started winning a number of awards 6 months after launch. But by then, you know, everyone's opinion of the game is kind of solidified. It's too late.
Yeah, it really demonstrates the power. Why we talk about how we do updates, because that's the main power of online games, is they do update, they change, and you know exactly. Anarchy Online went from being pretty horrendous at launch to actually being pretty fun for a lot of people after a while. The problem is, of course, games that do well at launch, even if they eventually do end up not being quite so fun, still have there's a better opinion of them in general.
Game. Does that mean the servers are going to go down, everything, you just won't have the game anymore? And how's that work?
Generally, yes. Like I said, 3DO closed down the servers, the Marine 59 servers here in the U.S. So between August 2000 and whenever we started beta last year, do you remember, Greg?
It's been 9 months.
9 months, okay. So we've been up again for 9 months. So since August 2000 and we relaunched, the servers were down. You could not play it legally here in the United States. There were some people that got a hold of some of the server code and ran unauthorized servers, something we're working to stop now, unfortunately. But, basically when they stop supporting, even if they don't take down the servers, one of the main things about these games is they are a service. So if you're not providing customer service, the game is dead.
Yeah.
You know, it's basically just a walking corpse at that point.
I had my hand up prematurely. Do you ever get a sense? I'm just wondering, the rapport between developers and customers. Do you generally feel that as developers, you're developing it, but you've probably got the corporate or somebody above you going, this is what we need to do, this is what we don't, but or maybe not. But do you generally feel that if something is going wrong, not necessarily like in the case of 3DO closing down, but something going wrong in that direction, do you sense that the customers kind of get that feeling first and then it bounces that way? Or is it something that the customers pick up on from the development or something like that? I guess we're totally getting sidetracked.
It really depends on the product. I've seen products where the customer base could tell that something was wrong, that they, big bugs were not being fixed, and that's usually an indication that the company's not putting any programming resources into the game. And I've seen other products that were just really caught by surprise. For example, the Neverwinter Nights, not the current version, but the old version that was on America Online, was a hugely successful product. Thousands of very dedicated customers. And then because some market changes happened, some pricing changes happened, and the plug just got pulled. So kind of people log in one day and it's there, and they log in the next day and it's gone. It wasn't quite that bad, but it was a very sudden, very traumatic change. So it really depends on a lot of different factors. But what I would look for to see if something's about to go down is I would look for that thing of, are there really big bugs that are coming out that they're not fixing, that they're not plugging the holes?
And not just that, but I'm sure you've all played games where in a graphical game you get stuck somewhere and you need to page an admin to get help, that kind of thing. And if that's not happening, that's another good indication that they've dropped the ball.
just one comment about, you know, size of companies. My boss is a real bastard. Of course, I work for myself, so. It also works on the other end, too. Sometimes you get a lot of players being really premature in their gloom and doom. I mean, you know, shoot, people thought EverQuest was going to fail since day one. Yeah. Even with the relaunch of Meridian 59, there's a lot of gloom and doomers saying, oh, you know, the company will never last another month. You know, sure, you know, it's not exactly, you know, beers and Skittles for us, but, you know, we're still surviving, you know, even though there's a lot of naysayers out there. So, but I think in general, yeah, I mean, people knew the writing was on the wall when 3DO was closing it down. I mean, before they even made an announcement, you know, I was the last programmer on the team, and I was being taken off the team to work on another project, you know, hint.
How do you deal with the death of a character, speaking in terms of what does the player get to keep and not keep and where they get to respawn at in the game world?
You mean character death, not like deletion of the character or where the character's permanently gone from the world?
Oh, no, I mean, like, you know, when, like, you're playing and you get killed in the game.
Do you want to start?
No, you go ahead.
Okay, well.
Very
funny, Akea and Aetolia, my products are quite a bit different from the Daiku or EverQuest model where you suffer quite a bit on death. Akea is very PvP-oriented, and as such, death, while it hurts, isn't that big of a deal. You keep all your items. You lose some experience. The main thing for players actually is the shame of dying. I'm a big fan of the idea of glory and shame in games. As players are looking to be made, you know, they're looking to accumulate glory and avoid shame. I think whether it's collecting the big items in EverQuest for the glory or avoiding the shame. For example, in my games of dying, no one wants to be the loser. You know, so I'm not a big fan of punishing players heavily for death. Yeah.
For Meridian 59, kind of on the other end of things, we're PvP focused too, but you lose your whole inventory on death. It sounds kind of drastic if you're a, you know, EverQuest player. The thing to keep in mind is in Meridian 59, there's probably no item you can't get within an hour. And we also have a lot of, you know, we have like backup storage, you know, so you can go to your vault and you have a full set of equipment. You know, the number of truly rare items in the game is minuscule. So, you know, and then on top of that, you lose a hit point and, you know, a few percentages off all your skills. So, you know, which is nice because it scales well. Newbies don't lose that much, but an experienced player will lose a bit more. So, and like Matt says, there's also the sting, the shame of dying, especially in PvP. You know, you don't want to be that person. You don't want to be the person that's gloated over.
Yeah, Dragon's Gate has a very lenient death policy as well, very similar. You don't lose your items. There's some time out of the game and chance of skill loss. But you either return to where you died or to a nearby temple.
And in our own games, it's all over the scale. We found that it's really part of the game design. It has to be put in from the beginning. You know, are people going to be allowed to keep their stuff or are they going to lose their stuff? Some of the most intense moments I've had as a player have usually revolved around a death and trying to save the stuff or you know, trying to resurrect someone before their stats decay or something. It's a very powerful real world emotional experience. Oh my God, you know, I got to mobilize my friends and stuff. So some of our games, you just drop what's in your hands. Some of our games, there's that delay. So at first you're just lying there as a corpse, and you know, a few minutes later you decay and then go back to the temple and all your stuff is there. Sometimes it's lying on the ground. Sometimes all your stuff is actually in a grave, which only the person who just died can go back and dig up that grave to get their stuff. Sometimes there's a timer on that. So the grave, you know, if it isn't reclaimed after a certain period of time, then kind of anyone can go into it. Then you get the whole grave robbing thing, and he stole stuff from my grave and we have to hunt him down and kill him now. And it varies. It's all on the scale. We need to stick with the microphone.
I wanted to go back for a second to the subject of bugs and the developer's responsibility and the player's responsibility as far as bugs go. Last night at one of the panels, there was someone making comments that basically using exploits, players shouldn't be blamed because it's the programmer's fault for not keeping them from doing it. And what do you, as developers, what do you, how do you feel about that? Do you think that it's the lion's share of the responsibility falls on your heads to keep people from doing the wrong thing, or is it really their fault for, or are they to blame for well, using these exploits?
I don't know if it's a question so much of blame. I mean, when we find someone using a bug, there's only been a few cases I can think of where we actually punished them for abusing it or taking the stuff back, because we generally catch them pretty quickly, and we have a small community, you know, relatively speaking to the really large games, and so the bugs tend to get reported back to us pretty quickly. You know, if people abuse a bug and it doesn't, big deal really, I guess. As long as it's not game unbalancing, we'll just try to fix it as soon as possible. It's, you know, it, to some extent it's our fault because, you know, we put the, you know, it's our code. But I don't know that blame is really that applicable.
I think that, you know, developers do have to take a certain amount of responsibility for bugs and fixing them. The two things I do have to say in addition to that is I think the comment last night was also pretty appropriate. There's kind of a social, it's kind of like the social contract of online games where people, you know, part of the responsibility of the players should be not to abuse bugs, particularly if they harm other people, you know, and like infinite money bugs do harm other people because they ruin the economy, you know. So if you're sitting there and you're exploiting some gold duping bug, you're not totally blameless because, oh, that stupid developer didn't close this loophole that, you know, took us 5 months to find. the second thing I'll say, too, is that some things are never going to get fixed. Some problems are just part of the game engine. For example, Meridian 59, just the way that movement works, sometimes you'll see people pop up over buildings just for a second. You know, basically, the way the movement works is you go in a straight line. And if it goes through a corner of a building, you see people pop up on the building. And, you know, people are like, oh, you know, that's a bug. You know, what if people could stop up there, you know, when they can't? And, you know, it's just not worth dev time to try to fix that. I mean, it's a bug, but it's just not worth dev time to try to fix that. It's not anything anybody can exploit.
Yeah. We have a policy at our game where if a player finds a bug, the first time they find it, they use it, that's fine. There's no problem. It's the repeated use of a bug that exploits a weakness in the game, such as affecting the economy, that we look down on. And we have locked players out of the game before for exploiting bugs. We have a small community, and we expect our players to uphold certain standards. And as long as we all work together to achieve a balanced game, everything works great. It's when players try and exploit it. Of course, the bugs are our fault. We have to fix them. But choosing to abuse a bug is the player's choice.
Yeah, in our games, it's a matter of degree. And there's some small bugs and there's some large bugs. And if someone's doing something that we have a reasonable expectation that they were doing it for a long time, they knew it was wrong, they knew it was big, and they knew that it was going to cause big problems for the game, and they didn't care, they kept doing it anyway, that I would see as the kind of thing that would be big enough that we could see locking them out of the game. If someone's just doing something that they don't realize it's wrong, you know, but sometimes you look at intent, and sometimes you have to look at you know, how big a problem it caused in the game, and was it deliberate or not. My own feeling on it is that if somebody was abusing something and they honestly didn't know how bad it was, I'm not going to lock them out. Unless they've got a long history of doing other things and then, you know, doing, you know, rule lawyering all the time and just skating this side of policy, you know, over and over and over again. I catch them abusing a bug, it's probably going to be, okay, that's enough to lock them out.
I think exploits in games are a very large gray area, and a lot of people have tried to turn it into black and white. And a lot of people say, no, it always takes the fun out of it. It's a heck of a lot of fun to find something that the programmers missed, and you're the first person who found it. Wow, that's fun. It actually really is.
It's like magic.
It's like magic. It's just when it becomes, you know, it's on a message board and everyone does it, that's when it starts to destroy the game. But I really do think the first time it happens, it's neat. They've deserved it. They found it. The programmers had it there, you know. It's not that big a deal.
Or maybe, probably not intentionally had it there. I agree with you. You know, finding exploits is kind of fun. You know, it really appeals to a certain percentage of the people to kind of explore the game and see what happens when you do unexpected things. That's fine. You know, hey, finding a bug, great. If you report it to us, wonderful. If you sit there and you dupe gold through it, that's bad. That's that. You know, that's where you start getting to the point where, you know, where you're going to have to take some punishment against the people. you know, hey, I agree. If you find a problem, if you find a bug, you know, we're not going to throw you out on your ear just for finding it. But, you know, if you exploit it, if you abuse it, hey, that's where you're going to get, you know, branded as a troublemaker.
And I think he had a question. Oh, okay, all right. The girl with the ears.
As game developers, you're all lead designers. What type of architecture for the actual game itself do you prefer? Do you prefer modular or just adding on as you go along as the game gets bigger? Do you design it modular from the beginning so when you do the big updates or iterative updates that you can, it's easily just tagged right back onto it, or do you prefer to see the large game as a whole?
I'm not sure I understand what your question is exactly.
Do you have a master plan, I think?
My question is more in the architecture of how you set up to design the game itself. Like the programming architecture. Do you make it modular or to plug in more things later on, or do you just kind of start out with an idea and does that make sense?
Yeah. Speaking for myself, it's always nice to put in hooks so that you can add you know, things later, so you can expect to add things later. But on the other hand, that takes a lot of dev time also. Yeah. And you have to strike a balance, I think, between getting stuff in now, because you have to get it in now, and expecting future, you know, planning for future growth. Because if you spend all your time planning for future growth, nothing's going to go in now. So it's a balance, I think. Modular is great. Hooks for future development are great. But our focus tends to be on, you know, can we get it in right now?
To delve a bit into the programming side of things, object-oriented is your friend. It's very easy. If anybody's worked on a even just a text mod before, you know what object hierarchies look like. So, you know, if you have a weapon class and then you make a subclass of sword and short sword, and then off of long sword, you know, you make subclasses of, you know, plus one and plus two or whatever you want. That makes adding to the game so much easier. Yeah, it takes a little bit more programming discipline, but it's, you know, and then when you go back through and maintainability, it's so much nicer.
Dragon's Gate is sort of a very interesting example. I believe it's been up and running for over 12 years now, and some of the header files have dates back to 1980. And it was not developed by people who were trained as programmers. To say that it was spaghetti code would be insulting spaghetti.
Certainly doesn't build an appetite.
Every time I go through the code, I find pieces of code that were put in there. Well, someday we're going to implement this feature, and there's just gobs of code that aren't hooked up, or hopefully aren't hooked up anywhere. Designing a game from scratch, would it be modular? Absolutely. Object-oriented, definitely. Would I use a programming methodology like extreme programming or something? Testing methodologies, absolutely. Is that in Dragon Feet? Not a chance. It's not uncommon to find the same piece of code nearly identically in five or six places in the code. It's one of these things with projects, they tend to morph over time. Oh, it's so quick to add this feature, I'll just copy the code I've got here, and I'll remember to optimize that later. And later almost never comes in games like this.
I'm not a programmer of a background, but I taught myself to code enough to start off a kid in 1996, and all the original code is spaghetti code, all of our movement code, and then everything that's been added on by the programmers we've hired since then who actually know something. Is good, and you know, they'll go back and just look at me like, what were you thinking? You know, what is wrong with you?
Some of the biggest problems we've had is dealing with magical spells. You can have a very clean code in terms of the areas and in terms of the combat system, but then you start getting into spells. You know, like you cast a magical aura on somebody, and so they glow blue in the game. We have a let me talk about one of our text-based games. We have someone glowing blue. So anytime someone looks at them, you have to put in there, it's about it's glowing blue. But maybe they're going to look at them. Maybe they're going to glance at them. Maybe they're using a familiar, and the familiar is you're looking through the eyes of the familiar. And so you have to get all those little places where the person is glowing blue. And then what if they walk in, this person that's glowing blue walks into a puzzle area that's an underground mine that has a dark room where it says you're too dark to see anything. Well, the player's going to say, wait a minute, I'm glowing blue, so I should be able to see something. And so do you want to tie that into all these areas? And so you can get very complex things where anytime you almost get a gridlock effect sometimes because someone wants to implement a new area and all of a sudden the magic guru comes up and the special ability guild gurus come up saying, okay, well, this area has to be compatible with all of our different systems. And you try and come up with as many different ways of making it compatible as possible, but then you've got thousands of players that are beating on it within seconds of its being released, and so you find problems, and then we get into the bug exploitation thing. And it's modular is the way to go. Unfortunately, it's difficult to do that sometimes.
Just as a comment, too, talking about leaving space open for future development and code you hope is not active, that becomes quickly the stuff of legends. You know, if some code accidentally gets activated, then people go, hey, when is the seduce spell going to be added in? Oh, that doesn't work. Well, when are you going to fix it? Well, you know. Can we talk about something else now?
So I have a question about death again. When you're designing a game, has it ever come up with the idea of giving at player creation, character creation, to give them a choice of how they would like their death handled? In other words, maybe one guy wants, okay, I'll lose the experience, and the guy goes, oh, okay, you lose abilities. Has that ever come up as like a possible choice at character creation?
I've actually never considered that, to be honest with you.
I'm sure it has somewhere. I wasn't around for the early days of Meridian 59, so when that decision was made, I had no input. One problem I see with that is people are going to quickly perceive one as better than the other. And so basically it's going to become the default. That's some of the problems with a lot of things that you put into players' hands is stuff quickly is perceived as better than all the other options. Whether it's true or not is a completely separate issue. So it more or less becomes the default. People are going to pick something they feel is going to be the least onerous. And that also is a balance issue where you're kind of limited in what you do with your game. So say you only make two choices. You can either lose your items or lose stats. And you have a game like Meridian 59 where items are pretty cheap. All of a sudden you put in high-end, rare, magical items. Suddenly everybody that picked, I'm going to lose items to death, feels screwed. Because they're going to lose all the nifty magical items.
To echo that, any choice that a player makes when they create their player that affects them for very long term, that they can't change later, you have to look at very carefully. And another reason to look at a choice of a death system, if it does turn out that everybody's choosing one over the other, changes to the death system will tend to target the one that most of the players use. And then you'll have new players come along. They'll choose the wrong one, and things won't work out the way they want. They'll get disgruntled. They'll get upset. And a death system is something that takes a lot of work up front, and just better get one system down right. Doesn't matter how you do it, but you have to do it right and be consistent.
Another thing to factor in is that when there is a choice like that, you have the players that come in, what I call the min-maxers, those who will minimize every possible disadvantage and maximize every possible advantage. And so you might have someone that wants to go around and use it as PvP. So they know that one character, when it dies, loses stats, and another one, when it dies, loses items. So they'll take the one maybe that loses stats, and it'll go around stealing stuff from other people. And then it'll take the stuff and put it on the character that cannot lose stuff when it dies. So there's really no way to get it back from that character. And I could see gangs rapidly forming like that, where they use the character that has the least to lose to go out and into the dangerous areas, and then they use other characters as pack horse characters.
Although, I'll mention we ban people for using mules, so if we catch you doing that, it's a problem.
It's been suggested that we actually add art for mules in our game, so.
but it's a valid design choice. It's just a lot of different things need to be factored in.
How do you guys find the right line between content and code and how tightly they're coupled?
using as an example where you're talking about the sword and the sword being a class inherited from the weapon class, and then the sword plus one being a class inherited from the sword class. I mean, obviously that's being done in the, at the code level. That content is being created at the code level and requires coding. How do you guys, the different ones, handle how tightly those two are coupled?
I guess I'm trying to think of how to answer that.
I can speak from general game development point of view. The less coupled your code and data is, the better in general. Mostly because that way you can get content generators in there generating content that don't necessarily have to know how to do programming. So you can have your programmers build a sword class, and then you basically have a big database. You know, sword plus one gives you plus one to hit. Sword plus two gives you plus two to hit. You know, and basically then creating content is just filling out a table. That's not the way Meridian 59 does it, unfortunately. Everything is in code. So, if you wanted the sword plus one, plus two, plus three, whatever, you'd either have to derive classes or you'd have to make magical sword class that has all these different possibilities. You know, ideally, like we said before, ideally, you want object-oriented and data as loosely coupled with code as possible. In reality, it doesn't quite work out that way sometimes.
Go ahead. After you.
One of the things to keep in mind is that these are role-playing games, and so 99% of what the user perceives should be content. So if the user is perceiving code, you've got a problem. So as much as possible, the objective is to make it so that the content developers are able to produce what they can, and then the changes are there to support the content.
We try to decouple code and content as much as possible because we have a whole bunch of volunteers who are volunteer. They role play gods within the game, and they also do all the building, that all the event management, that kind of thing. And since most of them can't code, we provide scripting languages that are reasonably simple for them to write mob AI in and that kind of thing. But most of them wouldn't they be capable of actually going in and altering the code, but we wouldn't let them do it because, I'm not going to really trust the volunteers with my livelihood, I guess.
I want to go back to bugs, and I just had a comment. I played Dark Age of Camelot, and I was down in one of the dungeons one time, and all the action going on with the spells, it turned on my firewall, and I got a virus alert message that jumped up, and it shut down my system. Boom, 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 boom. I don't know if that's a major bug or a minor bug or whatever.
Sure sounds like it.
But it was. It was kind of interesting. It, just the way it happened, I said, virus alert, boom, shut off the game, shut down everything.
Huh. Actually, that's a design philosophy that they made where if your window loses focus, it'll shut down the game. I personally find it very annoying, and I hated it. Because similar things would happen to me, especially instant messaging programs in the background. Would cause it to, try to take focus and cause your client to shut down. Kind of a little sidetrack. That's why, you want to make sure that, your design's solid up front. The purpose of that is actually, it's not them being malicious, is they're trying to cut down on the number of cheat programs you have. EverQuest had some problems with that where, basically the focus would go to a different application so you could, show EQ and all that stuff. So, that was a design philosophy, not a bug. So take it as you will.
Is that because of the Windows API structure, or is that because
basically, this is okay. Just a qualification, for you guys and the recording. I'm not a developer on Dark Age of Camelot. I've never played it. I just know. I've just studied a lot about it and talked to some of the developers behind the scene. What happened is we try to do in a lot of games, and we try to do this in some single-player games when I worked at 3DO on some single-player games, you want to disable Alt-Tab, so you can't Alt-Tab and shift focus. Unfortunately, there's a lot of other ways to do that, too, like you can use the Windows key and D to get back to the desktop. So they figured what was easier to do was to shut down the game if it loses focus. On the assumption... Because you can switch out of the game and into the cheating program and then switch back into the game and see the effects.
Does the cheating program, link into the...
Yeah. It leaks...
So,
It can link into the other program, or it can link into the communications. That's actually a lot of the cheating programs for Meridian developed have been doing that, where they link into the communications between the client and the server, and then they'll alter how the communications work. If you can't switch the program to, you know, because generally you can't control the program from the client, obviously, but if you can switch the program to do alterations, then, you know, then basically it, in reality, it doesn't really help. People who want to cheat are going to get around that. But, you know, it sets the threshold a little higher. So I'm not, you know, just a disclaimer, I'm not speaking for Dark Age of Camelot or Mythic. This is just what they've announced and what I've heard.
How important do you feel that role-playing a community is to a game, and what technical steps or modifications have you taken to encourage it as far as the games that you've worked on yourselves? As, you know, role-playing as opposed to just running around eat-bashing and leveling up your character all the time.
I'll preface that by saying I'm not a big fan of the monster bashing model, where the idea of the game is to bash monsters to get bigger, more equipment to bash monsters. But at the same time, so far as that goes, we try to enable more role playing in my games. But, you know, if the players don't want to role play, it's quite hard to make them role play. And unfortunately, one person who's not role playing can ruin the experience of 10 people who are role playing by running into a room and talking about gangster rap or whatever. And that becomes very difficult to enforce. There are some smaller mods that do.
We have some. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, there are some smaller mods that do, you know, enforce it. And we enforce role-playing very lightly and try to encourage it. But it can be difficult to do. There's no technical solution that I'm aware of.
In our games, what we have is what we call a role-playing bonus, which is that if we spot a group or people that are role-playing really well. One of the complaints we get from role-players is saying, I love playing the game, I love to role-play, but I feel like if I spend time role-playing and I'm not monster-bashing, then I'm not advancing as quickly as all the monster-bashers are. So it's a disadvantage to me to role-play. So what we implemented, and this was, gosh, I think this was in the early 90s, was a role-playing bonus, so that if a game master spots someone who's role-playing, they put a timed bonus on that character. And then every experience point that character earns is doubled or tripled or quadrupled, depending on how good that their role-playing was. If they drop out of character and they're spotted dropping out of character, the bonus is gone, zero. So they're back to whatever their normal experience gain was. Okay. And we have found people that will systematically increase their level of role-playing and their quantity of role-playing with the chance that they'll get a bonus. Now, it's a little bit like a slot machine. Just because someone is role-playing does not mean that they're going to get a bonus. We have limited manpower, so not everyone in the game can be watched at all times, and even if someone's role-playing really well for an hour and then so-so for 9 hours, again, no one may spot them. But that chance of when you are spotted and when you get a bonus, you know you get a bonus, and you get a bonus in a role-playing way. It's, you know, like a mental thing that goes on. And people really like it. They like knowing that their role-playing has been appreciated. And we've had a great deal of success with it.
That's a good idea.
In Meridian 59, I'm going to kind of echo Matt's feelings here, where, you know, if somebody doesn't want to role-play, it's really hard to get them to role-play. One of the bonuses of a game that has multiple servers, like Meridian 59, is that we can do things. Dark Age of Camelot did the role-playing servers, which a lot of people really like. I would have been playing on one when I was playing if my friends hadn't chosen another server to begin with. I know our German licensee basically followed that. They have a role-playing specific server for the German Meridian 59 version that basically, you know, where you have rules where, you know, you can't have outside names, trademarked names, basically. You know, all names have to fit within a certain genre. You know, you can't talk about outside thing. You can't talk about sports while you're sitting there killing monsters. And actually, the role-playing server has one of the highest populations. So,
yeah, on Dragon's Gate, it's a role-play mod, and as much as possible, we attempt to encourage people to role-play. Certain people are not playing the game to role-play. Certain people are there because they just enjoy going out and killing monsters. They want to make their character the best they can. They don't interact with other players. As long as they don't interact with other players, it's not a problem. It's the people who go into Town Square and talk about sports and cars and things. And those people, you encourage them to find some other place to play, encourage them to stay in character. But it can be a difficult problem. You just have to set the community expectations to begin with and hope that the community enforcement works.
In the back?
Yeah. Getting back to PvP and from a design perspective, my first experience really in the MMORPG was back in 96 with Meridian. And the single most frustrating thing ever, and still to this day, just about, I mean, there's been some advancement in the field, but griefers, just, you know, how do you, I guess, just as a designer, how much of your time is spent trying to solve this, you know, it goes back to, I guess, ties in kind of with that role play. How do you make people who don't want to role play, and how do you make people who don't play well with others play well with others, kind of, you know, about the griefing? How do your systems all work?
Dealing with griefing is without question the number one time consumer of our volunteer admins and some of our paid admins, actually. We're big fans of human intervention. There's no coded system to get rid of grief play. You can't, you know, in a PvP combat system, you can't code in, well, you know, if Bob calls me an asshole, pardon my language, if Bob calls me a jerk, you know, then there's no way for the machine, for the code to recognize that. You know, do I get to kill him for that? You can say, well, if he's attacked me before, then I can attack him back. Well, that doesn't work very well. So what we do is we tend to open it up. You can attack whoever you want, whenever you want, but we have admins that are actively involved in punishing people who we have a fairly strict set of rules that you know, determine when you can. Someone has to have done something to you, or you know, you have to be defending your city, or you know, that kind of thing. Human intervention is the only way I've found to really allow those kinds of possibilities to exist in the game.
Yeah, I'll echo that. It's really hard to do any sort of mechanics for grief play. So if we say somebody's grief playing, you know, it's basically a customer service issue from that point on. You know, we ask them to stop. If they, you know, if they continue on, you know, we give administrative punishment. You know, we get a temporary ban, or we throw them into OOG. And if it gets too bad, you know, grief players chase away customers. You know, so we tell the grief players we don't want their custom. You know, because if they're gonna, for every one grief player, you know, they might be chasing off 10 other customers. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't make sense from a business point of view.
I don't really have anything to add to that. You have to support the paying customers, so you sometimes have to prune off the bad ones.
Unfortunately, you know, there's a downside to that too. What you do in a K is, or Anatoly, is we have an issue system. So you file an issue against another player, you know, a complaint, and one of the admins looks at it, and you have kind of a negative side effect, because the more responsive you are to the players, the more likely they're going to use that as a weapon against their enemies. So it's turned from, you know, players issuing each other fairly rarely for, you know, really only large offenses, to now a certain group of players, not most of them aren't like this, but a certain group will issue at the drop of a hat. They'll issue in advance. They'll say, well, I think this person's planning to do something to me. You know, and I mean, and that really takes up a lot of our time.
I have a question about games. Seem to player bases, at least in games, seem to have an overall personality, and that's a generalization, but I think there's some merit to it, particularly in smaller online games like what you guys are developing. How much of that do you feel is just random chance, or how much of it is directed by the developers? Do you feel you're actually developing the player base personality? Or is that just kind of what happens out of random chance?
I think that people will be drawn to the game that they find entertaining for their personality type. And in that game, they'll find other people who are also drawn to that. So I think it's almost like an affinity group. In terms of changing players' personalities, I've definitely seen some teenagers who have played who I have felt like I was in the role of a parent for them. You know, they weren't getting any kind of decent supervision at home. They were acting out online. And as a game master, I was the one who had to take them aside and say, okay, it's not nice to hit other people. You know? and I've probably had some effect like that, just in terms of the, you know, direct parental supervision. But in terms of overall affecting people's personalities,
My experience is actually a little different. I mentioned before, we have our admins role-playing gods within the game. And every social structure in the game, whether it's a religious order or a city-state or a guild or whatever. At the top of that is a god that the rulers of that organization choose. And the gods are all, like I said, volunteered men. And so we use those gods to kind of inject particular cultures into the organizations in the game from a kind of a top-down standpoint. And by doing that, I think you can alter the culture, not just of the game, but of the sub-communities within the game. And we have different city-states in the game that have utterly different communities that are partially player-driven and then, you know, influenced, not directed, because you can't really tell the players how to act, but, you know, are influenced by the god who's in charge of that organization.
Back when 3DO ran Marie 59, one of the most successful servers, actually had a well-known guild start on the server a little bit before everybody else did. This generally wasn't, you know, overly common knowledge, but it definitely set the tone for that server. Even now, we do the same thing where, you know, certain behavior is definitely encouraged. You know, if people want, for example, people have items they want to give out, and they want to run a little event for people. I'll go down and say, hey, yeah, sure, I'll give you a help. You know, I'll put a special description on an item to help you and make it more attractive as a prize. Because, you know, we like people doing that. You know, and then just like on the other hand, you know, if you have somebody that's, you know, killing somebody too often, somebody that's making, you know, harassing comments, you know, these are, you know, yes, these are customer service issues, but the reason they are customer service issues is because we don't want people doing that. So, you know, I kind of agree. You can't dictate. You can't say thou shalt do this. But you can definitely say, if you do this, you're going to get rewarded. If you do this other here, you're going to get punished. And, you know, the amount of subtlety you want to apply to that, it's up to your personal tastes.
It's a very interesting issue, the culture that builds up around a MUD or any online game. And what you need to do is you can't directly shape it, I don't think. You can encourage directions, and the way you encourage the directions is to reward those players who are representing what you want to occur in the MUD and get those people to stay. It's your long-term players who really set the tone for the game. And if you have a player base that turns over every 6 months, it's very difficult to develop any sort of culture.
Back on PvP for a second, have you guys had any success with, like for example, EverQuest? You have to agree to be able to do PvP, and other places completely disallow it. It seems like it's not really worth as much of a hassle as it puts out, as far as people complaining and issues like level capping on, like you wouldn't want a level 90 person killing a whole bunch of level 1 people and stealing their items. How do you handle stuff like that?
For us, that's all, again, based on, that's all customer service issue to us. So if someone's doing that, you know, the reason we don't use a PK flag, which is what you're talking about, where you either can PK and be PK'd, or, you know, or not, or you, there's also area-based measures where certain areas are PK-able, is that it robs a lot of the, I hate using this word, but robs a lot of the realism from it, because there's a whole lot of reasons to kill someone besides having been killed or having been attacked. What if that person raped your wife? What if that person stole, you know, 2 million gold from your organization? What if that person insulted you publicly? I mean, it's difficult to do on a really large scale, I think, because of the customer service headaches. But I think on a small scale like us, it's one of the reasons people play a K, I think, is to have that increased freedom. Not as much as some of them would like, but larger than just I can kill you or I can't, no matter what you do to me, you know, or say to me, or you know.
PvP, I mean, yeah, PvP really isn't kind of a niche product right now. It really comes down to your game design, too. Meridian 59 doesn't have levels, and it doesn't take very long, honestly, to get to a point where you can survive a PvP battle. You're not going to be going and kicking down doors and storming castles and killing people with one blow of your sword. Of course, nobody can do that. But, you know, it's relatively quick to get to a point where you can survive a battle and you can participate in a group battle. I think that's one of the flaws of the level-based system when it applies to PvP, because, you know, the level 40 person is always going to be more powerful than the level 30 person. But, you know, in a system like Meridian 59, you know, if I have, you know, 70 hit points, I'm master of 3 different spell schools, and you have 120 hit points and I'm master of 2, who's more powerful? There's not a clear cut, you know, that's not level 30 and level 40. You know, if both people go at it and both people know how to play the character, that's going to be an interesting battle, even though one person's probably poured a bit more time into their character over than another or whatever. So, you know, really comes down to having good mechanics for PvP. And just every level-based system I've ever seen has not had good mechanics for PvP.
Yeah, I'd agree. I mean, using EverQuest as the example, where if you're level 45 and someone else is level 40, the level 45 person is pretty likely to win. We have
level.
It does. But you know, by as a general rule, if you're 20 levels higher, you're pretty much going to win the battle. You know, so we have levels, for example, but they don't matter that much. They help a little bit, but your skill as a player, as a person, is much more important in combat.
Yeah,
as opposed, because you don't just hit attack and then you watch your character attack. You have to do everything that's, you know. So
yeah, something else with PvP is that it setting a flag or not. The problem is that you get different personality types coming at it. You've got some people who don't ever want to be involved in PvP, ever, ever, ever. And there's others who are very unhappy if they can't be involved in it on a daily basis. You know, like, why bother playing a game if you can't go out and get in one-on-one combat with someone? But there's also a group of people in the middle who, in general, do not want to get involved in PvP, but every so often they think somebody really deserves it. You know, somebody picked my pocket. I need to hunt them down and kill them. And to them, there are valid role-playing reasons for PvP. And, you know, you can't really have... They don't want to have the flag on. They don't want to have it off. They want something, what I call... It's called consensual PvP. So, like, if someone picks your pocket, then you think, okay, that person has just given consent to be involved in a PvP thing. So what I'm working on something is a mechanics way of gauging that and seeing what activities, yes, if someone takes a swing at me, they have just consented to PvP. If they pick my pocket, if they are stalking me, if they're just kind of hiding and following me everywhere I go and giggling in the shadows, is that consent for PvP? Or some of the verbal things that have come up. So there's still gray areas there. There's also a geographical way that it can be defined. Like in a town, in general, PvP is not a good idea. You know, people should be able to go to and fro in the streets. In certain dungeons, PvP, you know, should be wide open. You know, yes, if you're walking around and expecting that a monster is going to be jumping at you from a corner, maybe expect that a player can be jumping at you from a corner. And then there's some areas that are like gladiatorial arenas where, again, you can put a structure on it. So I think there's just room for all the different playing styles.
I think some of our most difficult... Oh, sorry, Brian.
One quick comment is that, you know, PvP happens even in non-PvP games. Again, to use the proverbial EverQuest, kill stealing, you know, ninja looting, you know, all this stuff, you know, that's still PvP. The only problem is if somebody does that to you, your avenues for responding to them are severely reduced. You know, and so then you have the rise of things like the play nice policies, which, you know, some people love them, some people hate it.
We find a lot of our problems with PvP. We're a very organization-based game, so everyone's a part of multiple organizations, religious orders, city-states, and whatnot. And a problem comes when, if I do something to your city-state, you know, if I steal it or kill its guards, who has the right to attack me back? You know, is it everybody in the entire city? Is it? And that becomes a serious problem, because if you allow everybody in an organization to take revenge, then, I mean, you know, that person might as well quit the game right then. Mm-hmm. But if you allow no one, it's a very, very difficult issue to deal with. I just don't see any way to do it besides human intervention, you know, customer service. You in the back, you've been waiting quite a while.
Well, just to repeat, since he didn't have a microphone, he asked, where do we draw the balance between balancing the game and fun factor for the players?
I mean, it kind of goes hand in hand, I think. I don't think too many, especially in any kind of game with PvP, really any kind of game, I don't think players like to feel like they have the you know, the retarded stepchild class or the, you know, I mean.
I knew I shouldn't have joined that guild.
That's it.
I think, in my opinion, fun is paramount, and I'll echo what Matt said. In PvP focused game, people aren't going to have fun if it's not balanced. So I mean, I think the two are pretty much linked, especially on a PvP type game. In other game, I mean, even in a PvP game, in most PvE games, you know, things that are still a little unbalanced can still be fun, and I think that's acceptable. as long as people understand, you know, people don't start a fighter, you know, and expect to have mage-like powers at high levels, you know. That's when it becomes not fun, or if the class balance changes radically, some new technique is discovered, and everybody builds characters expecting to be able to do that. All of a sudden, the game developers go, that's a little more effective than we wanted. That's when you start, you know, that's when class balance can really impede fun.
And I think the other question there is, you have to ask, balancing for what? You know, what aspect are you talking about in balance? Because you could say, if two classes are balanced, well, they could be balanced in terms of combat, but imbalanced in terms of their potential to earn gold, or they could, you know. So I think balance is to some extent in the eye of the beholder also, because it matters. It's depending on your priorities as a player.
Balance versus fun, I think, is one of the things that can kill or make a MUD. It can't be overlooked. You can't take things to the extreme where, okay, people have to stop for bathroom breaks. Okay, people play the games to get away from reality. If you make every single class the same, nobody's going to have any fun. Are they balanced? Sure. Sure they're balanced, but nobody enjoys it. So you have to sacrifice a certain amount of realism and a certain amount of balance for a certain aspect, as you're saying, in order to make the game fun. And the more restrictions you put on the code to try and make things fun, balanced, the less flexibility the players have and the less fun they can have. So it's a very tough trade-off in finding out where to draw the line.
I also think if you want a perfectly balanced game, you can play Quake. That's not putting it down at all, but, you know, everyone's the same. You don't build up your character. It's all about player skill. So everyone's balanced there except for the fact that some people are a lot better at the game.
Where's the microphone?
Yeah.
Okay.
Nope.
Yeah.
On a problem on a lot of online games now, multiplayer online games nowadays, is that as the game gets older, the power level of the game goes up, because as new content gets added, in order to appeal to the higher level player base, the power level of the items that drop have to be better and things like that. So what do you look at when you're developing new content in terms of balancing that new content where it's still appealing to the existing player base, but at the same time doesn't obsolete your old content?
When you figure it out, tell me.
It's actually, for our games, it's not as big of a deal, because they're not item driven and they're not level driven. I don't know how you classify it, but none of the items you can get by playing the game are particularly difficult to get. Every class will have kind of their standard set of equipment that's fairly easy to get. It's not really oriented that way. So for us, at least, it's not the same kind of problem EverQuest has, where they have to keep introducing more and more powerful items. Otherwise, the other players have nothing to do. And I don't know how to solve that, to be honest with you.
Meridian 59 doesn't even use a class-based system. It's very skill-based. So it's divided into, you know, six very broad spell or skill categories. So part of what we do is a lot of times, specifically with this last, when we relaunched it, we had some content. What we focused on was basically filling out things. Instead of adding to the top level, we kind of went back and added some things to the bottom levels. Like there's this one spell school, Jala, that's a bunch of bard songs. It always had less spells than any other one, so I spent time adding like seven spells to it. They weren't all super powerful. You know, some were pretty potent, fairly nice. But I went through and I filled it out, and, you know, the next update, well, that's what I hope to do. I hope to add some low-level stuff to keep people interested, maybe a few more high-level things to kind of fill out, you know, the fairly thin high-level. But, you know, you just got to make sure it's balanced, relatively balanced. And even if it's imbalanced, the nice thing about a skill-based system is if you make one spell school a little more stronger than everything else, then everybody can get it. You know, you're not limited. You know, not every fighter isn't looking at every cleric going, geez, I wish I had, you know, the smite from heaven spell.
Yeah. Also, I do have some serious answers to the question. We release things, it's not just about giving someone more power in terms of more magic or more combat or being able to move faster or get more money. We look at the kinds of things that people see that gives them status within the games. And it's not always going to be combat or magic related. Often somebody gets status just by having a really cool item that no one else has, or having an item that does something that no one's seen before. For example, we did these snake charm bracelets in the game that bestowed to my knowledge, no combat bonus whatsoever, but it was really cool. It was a bracelet you put on your arm, and every so often it would kind of like slither down to your wrist and slither back up, and it was just some really cool effects. People were just falling over themselves to get these bracelets. So if we put more, we've been regularly putting more stuff into the game that gives people other ways to role play, other ways to get married, have romance within the games, other kinds of verbs, other ways that married couples can link to each other and instantly telepathically know where their spouse is in the game. And those are all things that can be put in that don't affect the game balance.
Right. You can expand, you can expand vertically by adding more levels, more power, or you can also expand horizontally where you add more capabilities to everyone, whether it's politics, increased economic abilities, things like that, things that don't, that aren't overwhelming,
And we're going to need to start wrapping up soon, but we can take a couple more questions.
Okay. I've heard you talk about text-based MUD, so I'm assuming that you think they have a future in the graphical environment.
Three people in Spell think so.
Yeah, I mean, movies are really popular, but I don't see the bookstores going out of business.
Yeah. Yeah. But what I really had a question about was I've heard also you talk a lot about the corporate structure, and I want to know about what do you think the future is of hobby-based, text-based games?
I don't think until a product comes out that lets you do easily configurable and expandable graphical games, I don't think text is in trouble at all. The text hobby games.
I'd like to laugh at this point.
Fair enough. Pardon me.
How do you attract players? Because the MUD that I play, which is Asgard's Honor, we're having a horrible time with our player base. A lot of the people who play it are the people who played Valhalla, which is what Asgard's Honor came from many years ago, and a lot of them are dropping out, and the morale is horrible, and the player base is horrible, and I hate to put down my own game, but
it's okay.
But the fact is that I'm scrambling trying to figure out a way to attract players, and I don't have the time, and nobody has the time to go out because we're all having to do day jobs.
Yeah, and that's a problem. I mean, we've been expanding steadily for 6 years, and it doesn't seem to be, both revenue and players. But we do it, we advertise for one thing, which a hobbyist MUD is a very difficult time doing. There are some still very successful growing hobbyist MUDs. I think, I think there's probably, if you go to MUD Connector, which is sort of the standard portal for MUDs, there's about 1,700 text MUDs listed there, and probably 1,650 of those don't get any players. And I think it's very difficult to do unless you've got a player base large enough to sustain itself, because there's a certain critical mass you've got to have to maintain interest in the game, and that's the only way. That kind of word of mouth, you've got to look at also providing an experience that players can't get on EverQuest or Asheron's Call, and that's what we focus on, is providing stuff that the big games simply can't do because they're of the scale.
Right. Yeah. Meridian 59 is a graphical game, but it's smaller scale, and I guess the big advice I can give you is make your MUD stand out in some way. Do something nobody else is doing. And that's incredibly powerful. Like Meridian 59 does PvP, pretty unrestrained PvP. We're one of the few graphical games to do that. It's not for everybody, but the people that really like PvP and like the system are going to come in. They're going to enjoy that. Word of mouth is your most powerful ally. I mean, that's something even as a commercial entity. That's what we do. We got word of mouth. Sitting right here in the second row, I'm going to embarrass you now, is one of our biggest fan site operators. And I'll be honest, without him, Meridian 59 would not have relaunched.
Oh, how sweet. Yeah.
Checks in the mail, right? No, but seriously, fan sites and even just, really dedicated players, they go up to their friends and say, dude, I just played this great game. And even if this person is more of an EverQuest type person, if their friend convinces them to come in and play, and they play for a bit, they might turn up their nose at, Doom type graphics or text, but eventually they get in and they go, oh my God, this is fun. And I think that's the biggest thing you can do. That's the biggest thing anybody, whether you're starting a commercial game or you're just doing this as a hobby, that's the biggest thing you can do.
I think we can probably do one more question. Yeah.
With respect to the whole game balance versus power escalation, I'm getting the impression that all of you feel that expansion does not have to come at the cost of escalation as far as development for characters. I think that the general perception from the player side is that you know, they really do want more powerful things. But in reality, I think for in order to maintain the integrity of you know of your game universe, you really can't allow the power to escalate. Is that what your experience has been?
Absolutely. Yeah. And we had this discussion, you know, back again in the early 90s, where when players were saying, you know, I want a more powerful sword, I want a more powerful this, and we said, we posted in the board, we said, look, if we thought that it was the best thing for the game, we would I mean, the CEO of the company would personally greet every new player in the game and hand them a plus 200 sword. Yeah, and the thing is, though, is that if everyone had that plus 200 sword, they would be deliriously happy for maybe a couple days, and then it would get really, really boring. So to have a good game, there needs to be challenge. There needs to be a feeling that when you're playing the game, you're accomplishing something. You're maybe seeing something that hasn't been seen. You're advancing your character. You're getting status in some way. And it can be very frustrating to players because if there's a fine line between when is it challenge and when is it frustrating. Like, I love puzzle games. I'll play puzzle games all day long. I know a lot of people can't stand them, so it has gone over that frustration line for them, whereas for me it's challenge. I want to keep going. And that's that is in itself a challenge for all game designers, where to draw that line and trying to draw a line in such a way that you will have a challenge for the most players possible, the most customers, so you get them in the game and you keep them in the game for a long period of time, and they continue to feel challenged as opposed to feeling frustrated.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. Another nice thing about having a skill-based system is even though we kind of rank our skills into different levels within the schools, that doesn't mean level one skills become useless as soon as you learn level two skills, and so on and so forth. So even if we add a level three skill, you know, it's not, you know, a super powerful level six skill. But it's still something that's probably worthwhile for people to go back and collect and work up. And it's going to enhance their character. It's not going to overpower. It's, you know, it's not the plus 200 sword when before there's only 150. But it's a little something extra to give them an edge, especially in PvP. And then they can go out, you know, and people with that skill might have an edge over people that, you know, decide, I don't want to work up a level three skill. Eventually, people that didn't want to work up a level three skill will be working up a level three skill.
All right, I think that's all we have the time for. I did want to say thank you to all the panelists for coming, especially our last-minute panelists there. Thank you all for coming. I think we had some really great questions in here, and I hope we get a chance to do this again next year. Yeah. Cool. Thank you.